it's kind of hard to tell if I've got a full house or not. This is sort of like teaching in a sports bar. All I kind of expect is get a waitress to come over and have her ask me, do I want to have water, water, or water? No, it's actually true. I was coming down and up one level, they had something laid out for all the attendees, and they had can after can after can of sparkling water. So it's kind of funny when I go to my vet. There are apparently some people who are vegetarians, and that's fine, but they try to make their pets be vegetarians too. And dogs, and particularly cats. I mean, cats are not designed to be vegetarians. They got those little fangs for a reason. And when they see a baby rabbit or a bird or any kind of rodent go by, they're not thinking vegetarian. So sometimes it's hard to get your animals to follow your beliefs. I guess that's true in general. Let me start this up. Cool. So the first thing I want to do is get the exams out of the way. Oh, there's a reading assignment too. This is the material I'll be covering. We'll be talking starting today about cogeneration type issues, and I've got some handouts to give about that too. Here's some information on the exam. I think there's some up on Learn at UW. One of the things it does is put all kinds of bar graphs and cool things like that. But the takeaway on this is that, for the most part, you all did very well. I guess if you look at the distribution the median is the halfway point, where as many as above is below, and that was 89. So it means there's many people in the 90s, essentially, as in every other grade at level. And even the people who didn't do so well, they didn't really do that badly. I mean, situation being in the 80s is not a big issue. Even in the 70s, and one person in the 60s, that was not as good as I would like to see, but it's by no means fatal. Particularly, I'll be talking about projects, and projects carry a lot more weight than exams, simply because computing is not really subjective, it's objective in the sense that, are you a good programmer? Easy way to tell. Write the program and does it run? You're a good programmer. If it doesn't run, you're maybe good about talking about programming, but you're not good at doing it. So that's one of the things that always drew me to computing, is it's very egalitarian. Doesn't matter who you are, if you do it right, the machine works, and if you do it wrong, it doesn't. And we'll talk more about that in terms of how software can help us out, but that's what it is. What I'll be doing is right first thing is giving back the exams with answer sheets. Also, I wanted to re-mention the picnic. I got my wrist slapped a little bit. Apparently, if you're Epic employees, you should not be signing up for the picnic. I know this place is crazy. I mean, it's so unbelievably rich in some ways and so unbelievably chintzy in others. So I guess they were afraid that you'd be stealing all that food away from those poor, hungry undergraduates. But it turns out that just by chance, my office hours that day are going to be held over where the picnic's going to be, wherever that is. And you may want to come over and talk office hours. And more seriously, we're going to have the chairman there, the faculty member in charge of the professional master's and the certificate program, and the administrator who handles all that on the CSN, the guy named Henkel. Some of you may have dealt with him via email or by the phone. And he's got all kinds of information about what courses are in the plans. And I just talked to him today, and he was very keen on hearing from you about what courses you would like to take or any ideas you have on how to improve the system. Our goal is, it's not a goal, it's going to happen, is this summer we're going to start yet another cohort. So there'll be another group of people, mostly Epic employees, again, I would imagine, floating through the system. And we're going to try to have each semester at least two courses underway. This semester is 536 and 537. I'm down for 367 for the new cohort in the fall. But we're certainly going to have one more advanced course. I think we're trying to make it the database course. The problem is the person who taught it the last time, Jeff Naughton, has been lured away by Google. So he's now a Googler. And, of course, that means he'll be doing Google-type things and not teaching out here. But at any rate, by all means, come by and meet some people, meet faculty if you'd like to meet them, ideas. And if any of the the security guards are looking, I'll distract them and you can kind of quickly grab something off the pastry tray or whatever. Or maybe you can wait, like here, I know, what's the protocol? I see that up in Mirror Commons, after a time, there's always a little bit left. There's a couple of scraps of bread and maybe a little bit of peanut butter left and maybe a couple of wilted grapes. And I guess at some point, you're welcome to come up and pick up the scraps rather than put them in the trash. So we'll find out what the protocol is and get what's left. Yeah, that's right. I didn't put the date on because I'm supposed to encourage you. But no, it's actually the first Wednesday of the next month. So it'll be day after my lecture and thing. So it's actually, I guess, the TA's day to do office hours. But I'll come out here, too, to help him out. He has been showing up for office hours, hasn't he?
Yeah,
yeah, good. I mean, I knew he had to be doing something. And I was just trying to figure out what it was. So... all the grading, by the way, is done by me, which is why it's all done. So what I'm going to do is, actually, since there were two exams, I'm going to do it in two batches. I have the exam and the exam answer keys, and of course, the exams were different. I think they're about the same difficulty, but they weren't the same exam. So these are all the exam ones that I have. A couple of people yesterday got it back, so let's see. Eric Hull, H-O-U-G-H. Oh, by the picnic, by the way, I was told that people who are in the program but not Epic employees, or a few of them, are more than welcome. The cover story is they want only people who aren't familiar with the campus to come out here and get enthralled by the beauty and grandeur of the place. So those of you who work here every day, I guess you kind of get used to it. It must be like working at the Metropolitan Museum of Art or something. After a while, they kind of new Van Gogh. Duh, what else is new? So, Nick Daly. Steve Tumaz. Patrick Ballum. Tyler Heslinga. David Kohler. Jeffrey McMaster. And John Brimlow. So those are just exam ones. I got another packet here for anybody who did an exam one who didn't get something back. Cool. So now we'll do the other batch, which is the exam twos. Since I'm the person who graded everything, I'm the person to talk to if you have grading issues. My only plea is check with me if it's a significant issue. Actually, 2 years ago, had a guy who argued with me, and I mean for a while, over a half a point on the basis of 100. What happened is I had a question that was worth an odd number of points, and he had half credit. So I think it was worth 13, and I divided by 2 and rounded down for 6. And he was quite sure, my gosh, no, that's that, no. You got if you round, it's got to be up. So, you know, it should really be 7. And it took me a long while to convince the guy that 0.5 point from 6.5 down or up was not likely to be significant in the big scheme of things. But some people, it's a matter of principle. So John Leonard. Samuel Lemley. David Hoyt, H-O-Y-T. With everybody spread out, I apologize in advance. If I'm looking in one direction and I don't see you, you're going to have to kind of up, you know, me, or something like that. Just like you're back in elementary school and you had to take a walk down the hall now. And if teach doesn't notice you, you've got to get noticed. Hussein Daoud. I know he was here. I saw him. Yeah, there he is. Brendan Checkett. Trang View. By the way, these are in no particular order. I may have mentioned that. Just they kind of got randomized as I was grading. Rachel Johnson. Tony Cardell. Andrew Hasokawa. Paul Ambler. Scott Diamond. Jordan Cox. See, Anna's over there. Another Anna, Novikova. How Nguyen, N-G-U. Jeremy West. Don Drager. Not to be confused with Don Draper, right? Ryan Jasinski. Zoe Johnson. David Gailhausen. Alex Postina. Don In Lee, perhaps Erica is the European name. Ben Moss. Andrew Phillips. Daniel Statenfeld. Dan, the last name begins with a Y. And there's some other letters there that. Sure. Liana Hershey Nexon. Mitchell Misbach. Dan Haywood. Chris Menard. Ken Stark. James, we kept you waiting, huh? Well, not you? No, okay. No. John Prewitt? Prewitt? Okay.
Thank you.
And a couple that were done. Let's see. Scott Harris. And John Fanguy. And anybody who should have gotten one who didn't? Okay, so we got some other things for you too. Let me get these out of the way. So what I'll be doing is I'll be talking a little bit about Project 4, particularly the thing that always people find most troublesome is parameter check. So I'll go over that. Particularly, we were talking yesterday about issues of how to best do parameter checking when you're doing name mangling, which is a good way to handle overloading. So we'll get into that. But what I have is copies of the assignment of Project 5, which is the final step, the code generator. And I may get time at the last session today to start talking a little bit about that. But I want to make sure this was in your hands because it's something you're going to have to be working on soon. But it turns out that we have something else that's very helpful, and that's very detailed code generation notes. Actually, four parts of them. This is the first one. So, in fact, maybe I can do them both at once. Because these code generation notes essentially detail issues about how you're going to handle some of the constructs we have in the language. So, oh God, it's going to be fun. Okay, get that all taken care of. So again, we'll be getting to some of that perhaps at the end of today's session, certainly next week. My plan is actually for the next couple of lectures. After today, we have three lectures left. So the next couple, I'll be going in detail on code generation notes. There's part one. Parts 2, 3, and 4 will be released online later in the week, and I'll bring physical copies next lecture. So for the next 2 weeks after today, we'll be going on that. And then the final lecture will probably just be doing a review session with respect to final exam material. Remember that the midterm didn't contain parsing, so that'll be pushed back to the final. And we may want to review parsing a little bit because that's kind of receding into the ancient depths, what was well over a month ago now. So sometimes that stuff gets lost in the fuzz. One of the things I want to do, because it works out that we have these two interacting issues, both of which are perhaps the hardest issues on Project 4, and that has to do with parameter checking and overloading and how they sort of combine. So let me switch over. And remember, the issue is in the actual assignment. There's a suggestion on a way to approach it, and this actually works well. But I'll have to admit it was originally designed for the older languages, which had methods called subroutine juji then, but didn't have overloading. So let's look at the technique suggested, and it still works out well, and it's actually what I use in my solution. The notion is that you have up top some definition. Oops, let's get this thing. Some definition of a method, and it has parameters, and that's really the issue here. So in the parameters, you might have something like int I, and then bool array b. Oops, this one has seen better days. And then, that's dead too. And then some body of the method. And this is the header. This is the thing that's processed in pass one. So what I'm expecting you'll do is you create a symbol table entry at the top level, which is the only place where methods go. That is in all the entries in a class, the fields followed by the methods. So you'd have an entry for P. So that shows the symbol table for P is pointing to this guy. And he says, hey, I'm a method. That's the kind. And in this case, I didn't show, but let's assume this guy is void. So the return type is void, and that's the kind. So that's the type. So he's a method, and he's void. But we have to have extra information associated with his def because the parameters are going to be checked at the point of call. So what I suggested is a list, and I, for historic reasons, show it as a linked list, but implementation-wise, an array list would work very nicely. So in this particular case, the array list will work nice because that means you can get at each particular entry just by doing an index. Again, remembering that this stupid issue that arrays index starting at zero. So the first parameter is actually the zeroth parameter and so on. And in this, what you do is extract type and kind info. So the type would be int. And the kind in this case would be a scalar. And I'll just abbreviate SCA for scalar. The second one would be an array, actually an array param, and its type is bool. So we have a list that has two elements, and that'll be used later to verify that at all points of call for P, there'll be two elements, the first of which is an integer value, scalar value, and the second of which is a Boolean array. So later in the method either of this in the body of this method or perhaps some other method, there'll be a call. And the example I used, P of 1, comma, true, I think it was. So what you do is you type check the parameters just to verify that for identifiers are properly declared and there's no type checks if there's an expression or anything like that. But what you then do is extract a list corresponding to the number of parameters. So again, in this case, it's 2. And what you then do is say, okay, what's its type and kind? 1 is a value, and its type is int. It's an int literal. The second one is also a value, and it's a Boolean, because it's a Boolean constant. So now what happens is you do this, and you say, okay, I'm going to look up P in the symbol table. It has to be defined as a method. It is. So method, void, in this context, that's fine, because it's being called as a subroutine. The harder part is let's check the parameters. So step one is, all methods have a parameter list, maybe of length zero. So is the count of parameters in the definition equal to the count of parameters in the call? If it isn't, you have an automatic error and a very nice error message. Error, method P is called with 3 parameters, it expects 2 or whatever it might be. In this case, 2 and 2 is fine, so that error does not occur. Then you step through the first parameter of the definition and the first parameter of the call and say, are they compatible? For typesets are very easy. So you compare this with this, and types always have to be the same. So int, fine and dandy, no problem there. Kind, you say, is a value compatible with a scalar parameter? What that really means is, could it be assigned? Because what happens is, in theory, when you're doing the call, this parameter is assigned to a local variable in the method called I, and it's accessible throughout execution. That's fine. A value is compatible with a scalar. I can assign 1 to a variable type int, which is really what I'm doing. It's saying, could one be assigned to an int I? The answer is yes, it could. So I go on to the second one, and it says, okay, I'm a value, but the definition is an array. So could I assign a Boolean constant to an array of Booleans? And the answer is no. Arrays are assigned arrays, scalars are assigned scalars. So this part is an error. And you can give error message. And in this case, you can give a very nice error message. Error, a parameter 2 expects an array is given a scalar, or something of that sort. You also check the types in Boolean. So you could actually have two errors on one parameter. It could be that you had an array versus a scalar, and maybe this was int, and you were expecting a bool. So here's a case where you could actually generate two error messages, because the thing's erroneous in two different ways, both the fact the type is wrong and scalar versus array is wrong. So that's the way I did type checking, and I still do type checking for array, for methods in a context where I don't have overloading. So first I'll stop there. Is there any questions about what I'm doing here? You may be doing something similar, because I'll show you if you're doing, to handle overloading, if you're doing name mangling, there comes out to an alternative, which in some sense is a little easier than this comparison, but doesn't give you quite as sharp a series of error messages. Yeah?
You can use this for overloaded, right?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, what I'm struggling with is trying to figure out like a good error message when none of them match.
That's hard. That's, as soon as you get to overloading, things get harder. The error messages become less precise because you know there's more than one definition, but you don't know which one is right. So it's sort of like if you look up, used to be the case that I would say to my parents or my teacher, what does this word mean? And at least in my parents' case, they didn't know, but they didn't want to say that. So look it up in a dictionary.
So you, like num match or something like that?
Yeah. So in this particular case, and we'll kind of get to that. I mean, that really is there. So this is how to do essentially argument parameter checking for a single call. But now we have overloading. And there are two ways of handling overloading. One of them is what I'll call the dictionary approach, because I'm not sure that's very standard, but it's there's one entry in the symbol table, like there's one entry in the dictionary for a word. So if you look up the word LEAD, it'll turn out there will be several definitions. One of them is, and they'll put this funny marking to say how to pronounce it, which I never actually fully understood, but LEAD can be pronounced as lead, and it's a verb, and it tells you what it means. You know, lead, like, you know, to provide guidance or leadership. That's kind of a circular definition. There also is a second entry. LEAD could be pronounced differently, lead, and then it's a noun, and that's a heavy metal. So we can do a similar thing in our definition if we had multiple definitions of P, and let's take a look at that. The one I think I used was we had some. And here's a case where overloading is nice because sometimes you want to add up a variety of numbers. Sometimes 2 is the most common, so you'd have sum of int I and int j. But I can also say, well, sometimes I have to add up 3 numbers or 4 and so on. Turns out there's some languages that actually allow you to, in a single definition, to have a list of any number of parameters as long as they're the same type. The trick there is that the language, not our language, not Java, but some, they say if they see a number of elements of the same type, they actually consider that to be the definition of an array of the appropriate length. And in the actual method, you get an array whose length you can check. So they have an array of ints, and then I could just run through them and add them up no matter how many I happen to have. We're not doing that, so we'd have this in there. And we have an entry in the symbol table for some that would be there. And this would be the 2-parameter version. And let's assume we also had the 3-parameter version. And then you'd have some would have 3 parameters. And since we're doing this dictionary approach, I have one entry for sum that says, hey, here are 2 distinct definitions. They differ in their parameters. In our language, the result always has to be the same. In Java, it's a little bit nastier because I have one of these return an int, and I might have another to return, for example, a float. That, I think, you know, just makes an undue complication. I don't know how many times people use that, but it is available there. In our case, the result type is always the same. So the result type of int can be stored independent of the parameter list you happen to have. But now we have the issue that James mentioned, namely, if we see a call, how do we figure out what's going on? Well, a valid call isn't too bad. If I saw a sum of 1, 2, for example, I'd create my list of 2 parameters, and then without issuing error messages yet, kind of in a silent mode, I'd say, definition 1, do you agree? It says yes. Definition 2, do you agree? No. And it has to be the fact to be valid. There's one definition among the list that says yes, and all the others say no. If they all say no, then that's an error. But now we come up there, how do I phrase the error? What I would do something along the line is error, let's say you did it with 4, just to show that. And you know, by induction, hey, there's a definition for 2, there's a definition for 3, so sure there's going to be a definition for 4, but not necessarily. So this would create a list of length 4. The 2 parameter version would fail on length basis. The 3 would fail on length basis. And I'd say error, wrong number of parameters for in call of sum. And maybe you can even spice it up a little bit, but something along that lines. So that's, and this is actually how I do it in my implementation. Historically, it's why, because initially I had a compiler that did not take overloading. At some point I said, hey, overloading is getting to be popular. More and more languages have it. Let's bite the bullet and include it. And this turned out to be the easiest way at the time, I thought, of doing it. But there's an alternative. And the alternative, remember, is for overloading is to have this thing called name mangling, which says I'll have only one definition per name, but I'll alter the name to resemble the, to include not only the method name, but also parameter information. So what happened is if I did name mangling, I'd have a definition of sum, and the code that Java uses in the JVM for an integer scalar parameter is simply the letter I for integer, C for character, and uses Z for Boolean. It doesn't use B because B is used for byte, and we don't have bytes in our language, but they had to do it. So in this case, it's sum of I, and there'd be another definition of sum of I. And I actually put the parens in the name so that the letters of the method and the letters of the parameters don't mix together and kind of look like yet a different identifier name. Since you can't have parens in an identifier name, clearly that's not part of the user's def. That's something you added in there. So now what would happen is if I had a call something of sum of 1, 2, I would therefore use the second definition, and in the other case, I use the third definition. But the problem is when I'm doing something like this, well, first of all, let's say how we do the checking in these cases. Turns out that we were talking yesterday, and there's kind of a cool alternative to this business I talked about having the two lists and walking them one by one. So let's first do a valid definition, a valid call, like sum of 1, 2. What happens is we can't look up sum because it doesn't exist. Now the name is mangled. It has to have parameter information. Even if there are no parameters, it'd have empty parens to indicate that. But what I can do is I can kind of reverse engineer it and say, hey, this guy's probably valid. After all, you know, the user should not be an idiot. So if we're valid, what method would be happy with this parameter sequence? So I say, what are you? Are you a scalar or are you an array? Because I'm a scalar. What's your type? I'm integer. So he'd be represented by an I. Second one would say, what are you? I'm a scalar. And again, I'm integer, so I'd be represented as an I. So now what I do is I simply walk through this list and say, if there's a valid method, it's got to have the parameter codes II. So what I now do is look up sum of II. Hey, I find it. Cool. My parameter checking is done. I said, here's the actuals. Here's the formulas that the user would have had to define to make this valid. Is it there? So in the case that it's valid, notice it's a little easier because what I do is I walk the parameters once to create a string, but then I just do a straight match. The simple table actually does it. I create the parameter list that would have been valid, put the parens around it, do a lookup of the extended name, the mangled name, and I find it or I don't. If I find it, it's valid, done, checking. If I don't find it, that means that definition does not exist. So let's show that example. So if I had sum of 1, 2, 3, 4, I would, of course, get I. And here's the spot that's a little problematic, because now what happens is I won't find it. And I have to tap dance my my error message a little bit. I have to say error, there's no definition of sum that fits this parameter list. And that's valid. But notice you'll get exactly the same message if sum was not defined at all. So if it was the error that you're just calling the method that does not exist, in my earlier definition, I'd look it up and say, hey, there's no method named sum. That's your error. But now I've kind of blended together, does sum exist at all? And is the problem is sum is not defined, period. So remember, I can't really easily check because I can't look up sum. I can look up sum with parens of various combinations, but how do I know which one to look up? Or it could be the sum is defined as here, but it's simply the parameter list that the caller gave me, 1, 2, 3, 4, was not valid. So I have to have a method that, error message, I should say, gives me a valid interpretation in either of those. So it's not quite as sharp. Remember back here, when I did element by element, I could get very sharp error messages. In this case, I could say, hey, it's the second parameter that's wrong, and what's wrong is you gave me a scalar when I wanted an array. In this case, even if it's not overloaded, if I'm still using name mangling, and why am I using name mangling? Well, as I process methods, I don't know whether there's going to be overloading or not. I guess I could do yet another prepass and say, give me the names that are overloaded and the ones that aren't. I don't recommend that. I think that's getting a little overboard. But in that particular case, all I would do just to carry this out is this thing would be looked up as P of integer and, not a comma, sorry. And remember, Boolean is represented as a Z. So IZ is, not the Wizard of Oz, but the Wizard of Is. And this guy would be looked up, and his definition would be P of I. And what the JVM does, it uses a left square bracket to indicate array of. So in this case, it would be array Z or Z. And of course, those two are not the same. So I looked up IZ, and the definition is I left bracket Z. They don't match, so I don't find it. So in this case, again, I get error. There's no definition of method P that matches this parameter combination. And again, that's not a terrible message. I mean, certainly saying your parameters are messed up, and I guess by implication, go back and look at your definitions and see what's wrong. Having two parameters, either the first one, the second one, or maybe both are wrong, but, you know, so the imprecision is not enough to turn me away from that. So if you're doing name mangling, this is an alternative. Got to do one or the other. If you got one working, leave it alone. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But now, yes.
Couldn't you just jam in another for the name mangling one? Wouldn't you just jam in another entry in the symbol table just with its name? And then, like, catch the duplicate exception?
Maybe. Yeah.
That way you can just look it up by its name.
I could even have a count of how many overloadings are there or something else. Yes, you could. I mean, that's carrying even further still. I think the nice thing about name mangling is it handles overloading at a very elementary level. There is no overloading. Every definition is unique, as it should be. It's simply the method name by itself is not enough. So it's like a situation, you have that all the time with kings and queens of England, right? There's Henry VIII, who's not the same as Henry VII, who's not the same as Henry V, of Agincourt fame, the famous Henry V movie, actually two of them. So they do it in history and all the time. So we're kind of doing it in programming languages. You're not just King Henry or in this case, method sum. You're method sum of I or whatever. So maybe I confused you more than I settled things, but I think reviewing it this case is good. If you're already well along on one and it's mostly working or is working, leave it alone. If you haven't done it yet because you're a little confused about what's going on, the way to do it is first make the decision. You're going to handle overloading. Are you going to do name mangling or are you going to do the dictionary approach? Having done that, if you do name mangling, then this definition, the idea of checking the actual call, extracting the type codes, they're called the signatures, the technical name, that would have had to been there, look that one up and either find it or not, and then issue an error message. I think conceptually that is easier because you can just walk along and say each actual parameter. Are you a scalar or... I guess you also have to check for things that cannot be parameters, like labels or methods. So are you a scalar or an array? If you're neither, you're automatically a bad parameter. If so, I either have null for scalar or the square bracket for an array. I say, what's your type? If you're integer, it's I. If you're character, it's C. If you're Boolean, it's Z. And just build up a little string and put parens around it in the string and do the lookup. So I think conceptually that's a little easier. I can certainly envision walking the parameter list and building the string bit by bit. Take the result and concatenate it with the next and the next and the next. So if you're doing name angling, that's the way you do it. If you're not doing name angling, you have the multiple definitions, then you do the list thing I showed earlier, and you simply have not just one list to check against, but multiple, with the rule is one has to work, everyone else has to fail. If they all fail, then it's an error. If, I guess, you can't actually have more than one work, because I guess when you were doing declarations, you were checking to see for multiple declaration. That's one of the cool things, I guess, also about name angling is it's a little easier to see if you have a multiple definition of an overloaded name. That is, you define a sum of integers twice, and only one of them is valid. So what happened there is you'd put a definition of sum of ii, and then look up, try to enter another one, sum of ii, and you say, oops, no, it's already there. So you can just say, error, no, this definition of sum with the parameters provided is already defined. So you'd have that. If it's the case, if you have the array, not the array, but the dictionary approach, you have to go through each list and say, does it match the first one? Does it match the second one? Does it match the third one? If it doesn't match any of them, then it's a new valid definition. If it matches one of the existing ones, you print out an error message. And again, I think that's a slightly more cumbersome check. So, everybody sufficiently confused? Yeah. Just sit back and think of it. But really, the thing is, first of all, which of the two? You're going to have to either do name angling or have one definition, one simple table entry store multiple definitions. From then, you can then make a decision. For name angling, you're pretty much forced into the checking I showed you, namely, find from the actuals at a point of call what the signature would have had to been and look up that signature. Because otherwise, you can't just look up under the name unless you do what James said and have an entry just under the method name with some sub-entries that say, here are the various overloadings that I found. If I was doing a production quality compiler, I might actually do that. But in this particular case, I think that's carrying it a little further than we really need to. And certainly, you now understand about overloading. You say, well, why is he having me bother with overloading? And the answer is it's fairly popular. Just think about just overloading constructors. Probably more than half the classes you have overloaded constructors. They almost always have the default constructor with no arguments. But many, many, many times you have something that sets this parameter or that. And you look up some of the fancier classes, and they have four or five, six, many different constructors so that you can set these parameters but not those parameters, let them default, and get whatever one you want. So I think it is something that is a very useful idea, and therefore we have to learn how to deal with it. And remember, in your business, you have the same thing. I mean, what do you do with people that have the same name? And you must know medical records, it must be a particularly terrible situation. Out on campus, the situation there, there's a guy who used to be an undergraduate. I think he's still since graduated, who had exactly my name. And what always used to happen is I'd go to the university store and buy something, and they'd send a receipt to him. And I'd say, where's my receipt? Well, we sent it. No, you didn't. And what happened is he and I were in there, and they take my money, but somehow they always seem to find his entry. Whatever. So you see the issue there. So it's overloading is a very common in human names as well as anything else. In fact, has anybody ever been to Seattle? If you've been to Seattle, you found something, another terrible case of overloading, and that is that Seattle's broken up into quadrants. There's northeast, southeast, southwest, and southeast. And in each quadrant, a street can have exactly the same name, and it's a totally different street. So you could be on University Avenue Northeast, and that's one street, and University Avenue Southwest is a totally different street. And God help you, you drive around, I'm looking for University Avenue, ha, found it. Oh no, we're in the wrong quadrant. We wanted University Northeast, and we're on University Southwest. So I guess that's the way Seattle, I guess, tries to keep outsiders out. You just keep driving around until you run out of gas or die of old age or something. So, any questions on that then? Or any questions on other type checking issues? Or just historically, the parameter checking and overloading are tied together are the hardest issues I think people have. If you can get those to work, the rest of them is pretty much duck soup, I would think. But maybe not. So the situation is now you've got, you still have almost 6 hours to work on it. So I saw some people working, you know, while I'm talking. That's okay. Yeah, James?
So bullet point says that expression, variables, constants, and literals of type int char bool may be typecast to int char bool.
Uh-huh.
So those are the only types of and kinds that we should allow.
Right, essentially saying scalars can be typecast and non-scalars can't. Okay. That's a way to read that. And there was a question on Piazza about how you actually implement them, and I answered that, but that was actually getting ahead of yourself. In many cases, the way you do it is you keep the internal value the same. So if I try to typecast a Boolean false, now what's false typically represented at internally? As zero. So if I typecast an integer, what integer do you imagine I'm going to get? Zero. If I have true, what's true typically represented as? One. And if I typecast into int, what am I likely to get? One. A little less obvious, if I have a Boolean false represented as zero, I typecast it to a char, what char am I going to get? Huh? No, I'm going to get the char with the internal code of zero, which is the null character, I believe. And if I take true, which is one, I get the internal character, it's an unprintable, whose code is one. So you know, just try to be uniform. So it's only when there's not an obvious mapping one direction or the other that you even have to worry about code generation. You say, well, that's a terrible conversion. But of course, you can always convert your own. And that's one thing about programming languages. You don't like what's built in, program it yourself. Other questions? Okay, let's shoot back and go to the wonderful world of code generation. So what happens now is we're actually going to put a program in a computer. And one way to look at this is maybe some of you have been lucky now that you're employed of building your first home. Some people like to, you know, to buy a home that already exists, but others, I see a lot of construction around here. So you can imagine, you know, you've got your acre of land off somewhere not too far from here. Okay. What's the town next town over? I come from Fitchburg into Verona, and what if I kept going, what would I be in?
Mount Horeb.
Mount Horeb. Now, Mount Horeb, I assume, has many cows and few people, which means it'd be a great place to have your little homestead and all that. So you've got an acre of land, and you got to figure out all the hard problems. Where do we put the tennis courts? Where do we put the swimming pool? Where do we put the putting green and situation? Where do we put the guest homes and all the rest? And then you're laying out the house, you know, and you know, is it going to be a ranch or multi-story and underground and all that? And I guess Judy must have a whole team that does that for all the new buildings going up. As every time I come out here, there's a new building. So, and, but that's good because that means next time they have a picnic, I'll be able to go and explore that building. So we're going to do a similar thing is that, remember that in the basics, all a computer is a processor and a memory. And building a program is really just filling up the computer's memory with the right stuff. The right stuff typically is program instructions, so-called code, and data in various formats. If they're characters, they might be in ASCII. If they're Booleans, they're zero and ones. If they're integers, they're typically twos complement integers represented as bits and on for the various types. So we're going to figure out how to do that. But we have to do it safely and reliably. And so we're going to have to figure out where to put data and instructions in memory and how to manage them. One of the things about newer languages is there's some management that goes on so that data can move, it can grow and shrink. And that sort of mimics the fact that as programs run, possibly for hours or days or years or forever, there's going to be a growth and shrinking of the program. In some languages, a program can actually get bigger because it can get smarter. We haven't explored that very much yet, but I think in future we'll see a lot of that, that programs will actually learn from people. Just like, you know, animals learn in situation area about what people, you know, like or dislike. So sometimes, you know, if you have a cat or a dog, you know, they'll jump up there and sniff your food and sometimes take a taste of it. And if it's something they like, they come back. If it's something they don't like, pew, and they run away and that's the end of it. So what we see basically at the very beginning is simply a memory that is a series of addresses, typically from zero to some very large number, because these days memory is very large. But interestingly enough, it's not as large as you might imagine, and I'll get to that actually on this slide. So one of the parameters you have when you buy a machine is how much what they call it main memory is. And these days it's typically at least 1 gigabyte, two or four, and I think I have eight. And one of the games I always like to play, particularly with professionals, is who's got the biggest. In this case, who's got the biggest memory. So it's pretty routine now to have 8 gigabytes. I think that's what I have in this little guy. But how many of you have bigger memories? It's certainly possible. Anybody have bigger memory? How much do you have?
16.
16. He's twice as big as me. See there? I'm kind of embarrassed even to mention. Anybody have more than 16? And I mean, it's not a joke. I mean, it sounds like you're being greedy, but one of the trends we have now is that we have so much main memory that certain data structures that used to be stored on hard drives, like databases, are now stored in memory. There's been a lot of cool research about how you reorganize databases if it's all going to be in memory. And you can buy machines that have, I think, up to 1 terabyte of main memory. That seems like a lot, but I can almost guarantee you that 20, 30, 40 years from now, when you're talking to your grandchildren about the old days when you were back here working at Epic, and you say, well, my machine had 4 gigabytes of memory, and the kids will laugh. You know, that's a pretty paltry machine. You know, it won't be just terabytes. It might be petabytes or so on. That's one thing that we've learned is no matter how much memory you have, people have a way of using it. So in the old days, you know, they didn't have digital music. They didn't have digital video. Just wait, and it's coming when they have digital 3D. And, you know, the situation, and I firmly believe that it'd be a situation now where you have computers and, you know, you really do a simulation where you walk through a virtual room and, you know, you want to get data out of a file, you lift up and make a move and the file opens up and, you know, kind of like the holodeck if you used to watch Star Trek. And it seemed like that was impossibly far away, but it's getting closer and closer all the time. So we're going to have an address space, but we're going to have to handle it carefully because we have a couple of problems. First of all, in the old days, computer memory was physical. All that means is you go into a machine and the machine specifications would say, just like you go and get a jug of liquid or something. So I have a jug of a forbidden product, although I don't think it's as bad as some people fear. And this is 1.05 pint or 500 milliliters. So it shows the capacity. And a computer would have capacity. It might have, and you're going to be amazed at the numbers, but you might have something as little as 32 kilobytes or 64 kilobytes. For a long time, 256 kilobytes, which was addressable by 16 bits, was kind of a limit. And it used to be after 65, you know, you get 128, 64, 128, and they did some tricking on that. So what would happen is, in the old days, if you wanted to run program, no problem. But suppose you wanted to run two programs simultaneously. Computers, even in those days, were fast enough that they could run two programs switching back and forth. That's called multiprogramming. So what you would actually do is cut the memory in half, let's say. Doesn't have to be half, but so if I had 64K, we'd break it up into two segments, address 0 to 32, and then 32 to 64. And it's almost like having a room with two bedrooms. And your roommate, or maybe if you have a sibling, you're obviously who gets the good bedroom and who gets the other bedroom. And you would actually compile a program for the lower end or the higher end. And you coexist by simply saying, you stay in your room, I stay in my room. You stay in your address space, and I stay in mine. But I don't know, and certainly for kids, if you have siblings, what are the chances that your brother or sister will never sneak into your room and kind of pour around to see what you know you got hidden under the mattress or something, you know, like that? And the answer is very high. Well, early on they noticed what would happen is if this program running got out of its address range. It decided, hey, I'm 0 to 32K is not good enough for me. I'm going to go to address 40K. What would happen is, of course, it would step on somebody else's program. And this is horrendous. It's bad enough that a program would fail because you messed up the programming, but occasionally somebody coming in there and stomping on some of your data or maybe destroying some of your instructions. So there'd be a hole in the piece of code. You'd be executing along. All of a sudden, the program would end abruptly because what used to be code was overwritten by somebody else. Well, you think it's bad then. Just think about now. If you go to a computer and you bring up something to process monitor, it's probably at this stage on all your computers, there's at least 50, maybe 100, maybe more than 100 processes running simultaneously. So just think how terrible that'd be if any one of these guys is buggy. It could get out of control and step on anybody else's program? And how do you know if it's your fault or somebody else's? And how do you fix it? Well, it turns out that this notion that came in there of virtual memory actually solved the problem. So one of the things that we currently have now is the issue that it's essentially impossible for one process, one program running, to step on another process's data or code. That is, everybody, it's like you had, and I'm sure you always dreamed of this, having iron bars or something. So you leave your room and your siblings and even mom and dad, who would like to sneak around too and snoop, you'd have this impenetrable wall or barrier. You know, you lock up, you know, like Fort Knox, and you lock it up and put the combination in there and be sure nobody's getting into your room but you. I guess mom would be allowed in here if she wanted to clean up occasionally, because cleaning is kind of boring and it's good that somebody else does that. But here's what the hardware and the operating system people did to essentially guarantee that this problem that I had right here cannot go into play. They created something called virtual memory. Now, what does virtual memory mean? Virtual is used a lot in computing. In this case, it means that the memory you think you're using is not necessarily the memory you're really using. So it's like virtual reality. In virtual reality, you know, you're a dragon slayer. And you know, when it comes in real life, all you're doing is on the phone listening to customers complain about this, that, and everything else. So what happened is they decided that you would write a program saying how much space you needed. And that's fine. You could say, okay, I'm going to have a program and I need 32K of memory. Again, that's very small, but you know, if you want to have 32 megs, you know, that's the same idea. And what happened is internally, each computer would have a base register and a bound register. And the way to look at that is sort of like this invisible fencing that people sometimes have for their dogs. You know, you can go anywhere you want as long as you don't go past the invisible boundary. So what would happen here is each of these two programs would be compiled by us as if it had only 32K of memory, and we'd use the most obvious address range, 0 to 32. So low and high would each have 32K of address space, but it would not necessarily have to run in the physical addresses 0 to 32. What would happen is for the low guy, we'd say the base is 0 and the bound was 32K. And the high guy, we'd say the base is 32K plus 1 and the bound, I got a phone in here, buried somewhere in here. And the bound here would be set to 64K. So what we'll do is, I guess now it's a good time to take a break. We'll come back to this, talk about this, and then talk about an even cooler idea, something that seems like it ought to be physically impossible, and that is virtual memory, and virtual memory with paging. And that's something which we all take for granted, but is really kind of amazing, as I'll explain after our short break. So it's about 6:30, let's take a break and get back here about 6:40, and we'll do the next segment.